Is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
Peace and love, party people. It's Talib Kweli, the BKMC, the MCEO. This is another fantastic edition of the world's best podcast, The People's Party. Thank you for riding with us. Thank you for taking the journey with us. Yeah, man. This person that we have on is actually one of the maybe
stop there. Don't do it.
So
do it.
You're not gonna let me do the intro?
No.
It's so much here though.
It's okay. We don't have to do that.
So how about we do this? How about you do the intro?
Okay. that's it. That's even more good. That's even more awkward. Listen, my name is Yasin Bey. Your people know who you are. That's Jasmine Lee. You're one of my oldest and dearest friends.
Yes.
So I'm just gonna dispense with any of the pretenses. I know we're having a lot of production realities going on.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna attempt, as we talked about earlier, to have as earnest and open a conversation as we normally do.
That's right.
When the cameras and microphones are off while they're on.
Yes.
Shout out to Black Alfalfa in the back.
Yeah.
Yes. You know,
So tell me more about Anwar Khalifi, because last time I was in Barcelona with you, you took me to an art exhibit. Whose exhibit was that?
No, that was the Joan Miró Museum.
Yes.
You were on your phone. You were on Twitter at that time.
I was taking pictures.
No, you were on Twitter.
Yeah, I took pictures and I tweeted them, and I was like, look how
fly. Oh, you tweeted about it.
Yeah. Look how fly my life is.
Right on.
But
those were the days.
Remember shows, y'all?
I know.
But tell us about this artist and why you wanted to showcase his work.
It's Black Alfalfa. I mean, come on.
So, Yasin, the first time we met was in Washington Square Park, and you bought everybody in the park who we were hanging out with and rapping with hamburgers.
I've heard this story many times.
Yeah, I want to thank you publicly, because you've heard it privately, but I want to thank you publicly.
I mean, I know what it was like to be, you know, I had many hungry days myself out mm-hmm. there, you know, by the park. So it was like, hey, you know, I know what it's like.
Right.
So I got a little bread. I was like, hey, you know.
Right.
Let's eat.
You had a couple of acting mm-hmm. gigs at that time. So we used to see you on TV and then we see you in the park.
Local youths.
No doubt.
Trying to do something creative and not,
right.
you know, get caught up in the streets.
Right, that Brooklyn bullshit. We was on it.
It was on us.
Right.
You know, it was on. It was around. Whether you was on it, it was on you. It mm-hmm. was around. So,
yeah,
that was the time. That's how we met.
Umi says, "Honoring your mom," which I absolutely love that song. I was just listening to it on repeat this morning. Such an important song. Her advice in it: shine your light on the world.
My mom's is my hero, you know. Mm-hmm. And my father's is someone I love and admire a great deal. And the way that song came out is, you know, it almost says it's a freestyle in essence in terms of the lyrics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the music too, it's just like, it was me in the studio, just came up with the bass line, I played the drums, and then I just started, you know, kind of talking blues over it. And it started, you know, and then Weldon Irving came. Will I Am played the
rest in peace to Weldon.
Rest in peace to Weldon Irving. And Will I Am came and played the Rhodes on it. And it was just like, you know, at this moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm happy it happened. And it's nice to have something like that just personal and dedicated to your parents be. recognized and appreciated. So, yeah, I'm glad people enjoyed it.
I'm honored to have a relationship with both Umi and Abi, and they have helped shape me as a man as well, just from their influence in my life as well. So I appreciate them as well.
So same with you. I mean, your parents too, is Dr. Green and your dad, just their presence in the community and, you know, in your life has been, I mean, it's the elders, it's the OGs. I mean, you know, you may not always agree with them, but they, you know, they merit respect and, you know, because they survived. So, and my mother and my father came up with some very challenging times and eras, and they shared a lot of, you know, necessary and positive information and examples with me. And my father, I mean, I don't think, you know, every so often, not more than every so often, and I'm quoting something that he said to me as a young, boy or as a young man, or, you know, as an adult, that really resonated. You know, that he's like a treasure trove of them. 10% condition, 90% response. So you know, he's like that guy. You know,
I feel one of the greatest accomplishments is to make your parents proud. And I know your mother probably really felt amazing having the song, I mean, having you write a song pretty much kind of dedicated to her. How did she feel when she heard it?
She feels good about it, you know? I mean, you know, it wasn't like, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, if one of my sons, if one of my kids, you know, have wrote a song about me, it kind of would be like one of these moments like, wow, you know? Mm-hmm. So I guess I can relate to it from that point of view, but she didn't say she approves, which is, you know, all I could ask for. There's certain things that she didn't like. There's one thing that I did that she didn't like.
What was that?
She didn't like the Sex, Love, and Money video. I like that video.
I mean, the video goes with the song, you know.
It goes with the song, but she didn't like it.
Right.
And it was the first time that I had heard her like express like displeasure with the thing. Mm. She got the narrative, but she didn't like the video, and I was like, oh wow.
Right.
And you know, in hindsight, it was like, you know, I got it. I was like, yeah, well, you know, I kind of understand why my mom's not like that video. You know? I was having a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a good time. It was a good time. You mentioned earlier UTDs, the group you were in with Seth and DCQ, brother Denard. Seth is my friend who you saw earlier when we were setting up.
Right.
And, I was like,
we seen Seth out mad times.
Yeah. You seen Seth out all the time. Now,
yeah, all the time.
I'm going to do soon on my IG, like a Mos Def DJ set, and I was collecting all the records together, and I played Manifest Destiny. And Seth jumped up, right? And he's like, what you know about that song? I'm like, what you mean? He's like, I had that song on a TDK back in the day. I don't know who it is. All I know is that song is the shit. And I said, well, let me bust your head for a second. You know who's rapping on that song? It's Mos Def rapping on a song. He said, no, it's not. What you talking about? I pulled up the video. And he said, that is Mos Def.
Yeah.
So
wow.
I know personally how much you're inspired, particularly by DCQ, the creation of UTDs, the creation of Medina Green. But can you tell my audience who DCQ is and what he means to you?
DCQ... wow, what I mean, it's like a legend.
Yes.
DCQ was acronym. Yeah, you know the flex. DCQ was an acronym for when my brother Denard was a teenager in Flatbush in like the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, and he was part of a gang basically called United Kings. Mm-hmm. And his acronym was DCQ, Destroying Competition Quickly.
Yeah.
to give you some idea how, like, you know, how the eighth grade was on it in like 89. You know what I'm saying? That's how Flatbush was.
No
was
doubt.
Getting into
I was in a gang called Outlaws of Destruction. We wasn't outlaws and we didn't destroy anything. But that's what we called ourselves.
But so that's how DCQ got that name. Mm-hmm. He was he was like a touchstone for every hard rock teenager in my neighborhood, you know, like East Flatbush, Parkside, and all of that. Like, you know, all the local roughnecks was he was like a clearinghouse for them. He knew all of them. And on the other side of it, I was completely different. Like, I was, you know, my brother was very social, and I was not. And we have very different interests. And he recognized, talent in me as a writer. And I'll never forget, we were sitting there one day in the house, on Hoyt Street. Mm-hmm. And we were watching Video Music Box. So I'm aging myself, but it's so what? We're watching Video Music Box. For people that don't know, it's when you could, you know, watch videos on TV and call up on your phone and request videos.
Not only that, Yasin, but I was watching Video Music Box one day, and I saw Umi giving a shout out to you, to Ralph McDaniels, and Ray DeJean.
Really?
Yeah. One of her
My
friends.
My mom?
Yeah.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
local people.
That's right.
So, we was watching Video Music Box, and Common's single, when he was Common Sense, Common's single for Take It Easy had come out. It was his first single off of the Can I Borrow a Dollar album. And we was like, oh, it's still for Chicago. It's dope, you know? It's like that. And we watched that video, and D said to me, he was like, yo, son, we could do this. I was like, do what? Order another video? He was like, nah, we could do this. Like, we can do that. What they doing, we can do it. And I was like, yeah, okay. if you say so, you know. And he was dead serious. He saw something. And so he started, like, you know, just making it happen in terms of, like, you know, connecting us to people and getting studio times, things that I never would have known how to do or would have been even, like, you know, forthright enough to do. But he really respected me as a writer. All my homies did. I mean, MCing was that thing that's like, from the first time that I did it, I excelled at it. You know, it was when I was 9 years old, it was the first time that a lot of my neighbors really heard me speak in a way that, you know, that they understood or were interested in. And when I did it, they were like, oh, wow, like, okay. So, it was a way for me to connect with my neighborhood on like, equal ground. Because apart from that, I was just on another page. Mm-hmm. In terms of my interests and, you know, temperament, all of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, long story short, D was very influential in that way. And he was like the manager almost to a certain degree. And I was the creative. So came up with this name for this group, Urban Thermodynamics. And I remember walking by on Parkside Avenue, so this truck that said thermodynamic heating, and I was like, thermodynamic. It's just, you know, the scientific aspect.
I know them trucks,
just, appealed to me, and I was like, urban thermodynamics. And I looked it up, it said creating heat and energy. I was like, yeah, okay, this is like, you know, a thing. So we recorded a demo. You know, Sess was my best friend in high school, and she was like my female social twin in a lot of regards. She, because, you know, she listened to Fishbone and De La Soul and 24/7 Spies and had dreads and, you know, was just like the coolest individual, girl or guy, that I had ever met up until that point.
Bars, too, and, like, bars.
And she
MC.
Just had so much charisma and personality that I was like, and, you know, she said, I rhyme a little, she sing, you know, she just, we were in the drama program together. And she just had, like, cool shit going on in her life. You know, she had a lifeguard license. So in the summer, she always had money because she could lifeguard, you know. So it's like when you're 15 and broke and your best friend is like, you know, I got money, you're like, wow, this is like, person's like a magician. they have actual their own money that their parents didn't give them, you know what I'm saying? I couldn't get a job to do nothing, Jesus. Like nothing. Like nobody was hiring Dante Smith at that time. She had a job lifeguarding in the building where Miles Davis lived.
Mm. Wow.
So she was like cool with Miles Davis because he had come to the pool.
Wow.
And like talk shit to her. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Like you talking to Miles Davis? Wow. And I'd be like, you gotta let me come up there. She'd be like, no, because you're not.
You ain't fucking up my job.
Yeah, you know. And I used to come meet her. He used to live over the Russian Tea Room.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
On 57th Street. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Mm. You tell me about Miles is funny. He used to make passes at her and shit. It was cute. She thought it was cute, you know. And anyway, Seth is my best friend, my best homie, the person I felt like the most comfortable with, understood me. And I had like this huge crush on her, but it was going nowhere. So I was like, we just friends.
Right.
And when I figured, I was like, we put a group together because the Fugees was out at that time. So my idea was like, so I got DCQ here. I got Sess. I got me. We could be like, you know, a Brooklyn version of the Fugees, but like, you know, more rough. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, like BK 90 style.
With bottom fronts.
Yeah, with bottom fronts like that. Like Fugees with bottom fronts, basically. You know, covering like Flatbush, Bed-Stuy, and like Bay Ridge, where Sess was living on the Army base.
Right. On the 90s. Is that where the video was filmed? It looked like it was filmed like in the...
Nah. We filmed that someplace like actually, I think it was in Jersey or something. Okay. Jersey City, someplace in New York, some abandoned, you know, like open field. It used to have a lot of that back in the day. It was just like, you know, undeveloped space in the metro. Not no more, but so that was the beginnings of UTD when we did My Kung Fu, and you know, people heard it, people liked us, and it was different. Mm-hmm. But they responded to Sess's voice, they responded to DCQ's persona, and it responded to me and my voice and my writing. So what I did is like, you know, because I had all these rhymes that I was writing, and I just handed, you know, basically rhymes out to everybody. I was like, okay, you say this. And, and they wrote some of this stuff, to be fair, but, like, to keep the thing going, I was just like, you know, I had all of this writer's energy in me, so I just wrote for everybody, basically.
Right.
And that's basically how it went. You know, we had a deal on Payday Records and worked with DJ Backspin, who had worked with Busta Rhymes at the time, and... So it was an exciting time. I was like 18, 19 years old.
Dang.
Word.
Black Star is looked at as one of the most important pairings in the history of rap. And I really think people just want to know everything that they can about that era in both of your careers.
They what can't. Do you guys... It's not possible.
Let us in.
No. It's not possible. It's really seriously because like, Kwa can attest to this, like, if you weren't there, you weren't there. Kwa talks about a lot of that era in his own book, you know, like, about what that was like and the thing. But it's like, it's a New York of another time. It's an America of another time. It's pre-internet. It's pre-a lot of stuff, you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, trying to describe the beginnings of, you know, Mississippi Delta blues. It's like you could give somebody, like, a feeling and certain sort of touch tones, but, you know, you can't... The music is the vehicle for travel to that era if people are interested in it. But it's actually, like, beyond that era because it was just something that's kind of beyond time. Like, it was influenced by an era, but it's not... I don't think it's trapped in that era at all. I mean, you know, I'm not a big fan of nostalgia myself. I like to, you know...
But it is interesting that you say that because a lot of what our era represented to me, from my vantage point, and what made us stand out, I think, is our appreciation for what came before us, particularly on the Black Star album. I think we leaned into that. Like, we talked about Rocksteady. We talked about what hip-hop was. We talked about, you know, B-boys. And I think that was important for us artistically. Even in our ciphers in the park, when we first started really hanging out, it was a lot of, we keep in hip hop, we are trying to preserve this culture. You know, it's like, you said real life documentarians.
Yeah, a cultural preservationist, mm-hmm. so to speak. But you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's come on, like, we were like, you know, 20 years old, you know, mm-hmm. 22,
that's the
23.
Best time
it's
to like, live.
I mean, it's just coming from another time in our growth and development. And for me, those things were like so personal to me. They weren't necessarily even about like some sort of even cultural preservation. I mean, mm-hmm. that aspect of it was there, but it was like, this is what's important to me. You know, I you know, when I was 9 years old, I went on a great adventure bus ride with the staff from the Fever nightclub, you know, with they, you know, friends and loved ones with right. Melly Mel and, you know, Grandmaster Flash and all of them, like, you know, me and my brother, like, spazzing out that we were not only going to Great Adventure with brand new black Lee denim suits on,
right?
But they're like, you know, we were sitting next to Mr. G, who, you know, whom, you know, recorded games people play, you mm-hmm. know, and like Melly Mel from the, you know, and Grandmaster Flash, if it was like, it was crazy to us. So it was like, you know, it was like being on, it's like being on the bus of Michael Jackson to somebody, seriously. Right. In my childhood, it was like Michael Jackson and hip hop. That was it. It was Michael Jackson and anybody that made hip hop. Run DMC, Grandmaster right. Flash.
You worked with Michael Jackson as a young man as well. So it was like you was manifesting that destiny.
I see what you did there, but I'm gonna let it go.
let that punch slide.
Let it go.
Okay, what you can tell me, and both of you guys can answer this, can you give me a funny story that you guys remember from that time that you have not shared before?
I'm almost 50. I mean, like, I got so many stories in my damn head. I don't know. Like, people had to tell me stories that I forgot about. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. I remember moments, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I remember feelings and times. Mm-hmm. I remember writing for the Black Star album in the basement of Quality's house and that being like a lot
4709 Avenue K.
Yeah, I remember that being like a lot of fun. And like me looking forward to doing that as often as I could. I remember a lot of that era just like writing rhymes and listening to beats and just being like really comforted by that.
Yeah.
And having something positive to do with my day and time and my energy.
Sean J. Period like really, beats, high tech beats.
Or beat you tapes. Know, the Stunts Blunts and Hip Hop album.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Just being like, this nigga Diamond D is
right. And that Manifest Destiny again, y'all rapping over that intro
It comes from the Diamond D album. So it's like I remember all of that. I remember where I was when I first heard Low In Theory. It was like, what the fuck is that? You know what I'm saying? And I remember a lot of people from that time that are not here anymore. Some of my mentors, like Suleiman Hakeem, Rahimullah, and others, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's not like stories or like anecdotes or like, you know, we went into the Waffle House, right? And there was a dude with a blue shirt. And I was like, look at that dude. No, that's not my memories are like a little bit different. I remember like the vibration and the feeling at the time.
Yes.
And some of it was challenging too. It was like the city was, people talk about this golden era and all of that shit, but it was like, it still was New York City. Mm-hmm. There was not a lot of interest in young black people doing anything creative. Like, you know, it was like y'all just like, you know, slackers, basically. Mm-hmm. You want to just sit around in the park, hang out all day, smoke cigarettes, smoke weed, drink, get in trouble, and go clubbing. And 50% of that was true. But there was another part of it that was just like, you know, a lot of those slackers were super talented people.
Right, intelligent people. And brilliant.
Intelligent people, sensitive people, strong people who are, you know, like dealing with real issues in their life and their homes, their families, sometimes issues with health. Shout out to Beasley. Remember Beasley who ran Trip and Mars and all that shit? Like, people talk about Peter Gation in New York City, but it was all about 6 foot something. Beasley with, mm-hmm. you know, dark skin with blonde hair passing out flyers right. to the dopest party in New York right. City. You know, you go to Mars with four floors and they had House on one floor yeah. and hip hop on one floor. Yeah. And that shit was unheard of. Like, people who listened to hip hop went to hip hop clubs. And people mm-hmm. that listened to House went to mm-hmm. house clubs. And he brought that shit together. So those are the things that I remember from that. And I remember the whole ecosystem of the city. And, like, how, as I look back, I can't find a parallel during that time or any other time where there was anything like that going on anyplace else. Mm-hmm. You know, I know they was having fun in other places in the world, or other parts, other cities of America, but what was happening in New York,
yeah,
in New York City,
yeah.
when we was 17, 18, 19, 15, 16 was like it was no parallel. It was yeah. like it wasn't going on in London, it wasn't going on in Berlin, it wasn't going on in Paris. We thought it might have been, it was reported like it was, but New York was just on some
red hot,
some other shit. And it was red hot, and it had all of the like the beautiful elements, the culture, everything, all of the super dangerous shit. Like anything could happen to yeah. you at any time. It could yeah. pop off like day or night. You know, it wasn't like, oh, it's, you know, anything could happen to anybody.
He was born in Fear City. That's what they called it the year I was born. You know, we born Fear. In the 70s, Fear City.
Fear City, yeah. yeah. I mean, and 1977, you know, it was serious era. Yeah,
yes,
know?
Indeed.
Serious era.
I wasn't going to the club during that time, but I remember my mother, I just said you had young parents. My mom was 21 when she had me, so she was still clubbing and partying. And I remember I used to be like, I cannot wait till I get 18 so I can go out, because my mom and my aunt used to stay in the city and come out, and we'd be like eavesdropping and listening to all their stories from the night before. And it was like one yeah. of my biggest goals to get out and party in New York City.
And party like your parents, yeah.
Mm-hmm. yeah.
I just wanted to be cool. All of the cool kids was hanging out. And it was some of just the dopest music. I mean, as a music mm-hmm. lover, you know what I'm saying? It's like you go to hear certain people play and be like, whoa. And then to see certain people yeah. dance. Like,
yeah, we followed dance. Dancers was celebrities. You go see man, Henry and Stratton, yeah, Mark right. West, and Rubber Band, right. and Peekaboo. And,
oh, yeah.
yeah.
Black Rob and yeah. all that, like, you know. Voodoo Ray,
rest in peace.
Rest
Man,
in peace, Voodoo
what
Ray.
Great, what a great dude.
Marjorie, yeah. you know, Asia. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, people was like celebrity. Khalif, all
yeah,
of the.
Yeah, Khalif was ill.
You know what I'm saying?
Khalif was ill.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
yeah. Wow.
And then it was like rock and roll
minute.
And punk rock and going mm-hmm. on at the same time. It was like, New York was like, whoa. It's
yeah,
like, mm-hmm. I don't know another place that was quite doing it like that, you know. So
nah, I agree.
I'm grateful that we came up in that era and that we're still here.
Absolutely.
Amen to that.
Now I want to talk about blackness a little bit. Your debut album, Black on Both Sides. You call yourself Black Dante. You have a band called Black Jack Johnson. You in Black Star, but recently you and me in conversation. We've talked about blackness and sort of moving away from identifying so much as blackness, but talking more about the African politic, because race is a social construct. Can you break some of that down?
Well, as I've said before, there's a quote from my childhood, one of my childhood friends, Kasim Magnetic.
Peace to Kasim Magnetic.
He said, as black as white as money is all unequal. The adjectives can never be nouns. We are the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that ideology of blackness when I was younger was taken from the examples of people like, of course, Muhammad Ali and mm-hmm. Malcolm X and others. But for me, primarily them. And also like X-Clan and mm-hmm. the Jungle Brothers and Native Tongues and that whole thing that had a big, big impact on me. Like Native Tongues,
absolutely.
But I mean, Jungle Brothers in particular, that first and second album, Straight Out the Jungle, Jump Out of Forces and Ages. It's like, you know, educated man from the motherland. You see me, call me a star, but
that's not what I am.
I'm a jungle brother, true blue brother. And I've been in many places you never discover. So that whole ethos was in the city, you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? Like people on the, you know, booksellers selling, you know, message to the black man, behold the pale horse, Sheik Anti Diop. You know, that was like, that was the ethos of our youth. So, and it was, it to be fair, it was like the cultural status quo. Like, if you wasn't on that, you wasn't even invited. Like, nobody wanted to hang with you. Nobody wanted to be with you.
That's an interesting point that get lost in the retelling of that history.
Yeah,
it was
like,
popular.
There was no, it was like there was nothing else to be on. You know what I'm saying? Like the hard rock, the hardest MC, like solo MC at that time, was Rakim.
Yeah.
And he was rocking gold chains, but he was like, so follow me. So you think you was first, let's travel at magnificent speeds around the universe. But can you say is the earth gets further and further away, planets smaller, balls of clay. So it's like, these dudes are like velour and leather, you know, sweatsuits and gold chains, like thinking of a master plan. You know, it was like, that was the status, that was the status quo. And that was it. You know, like there was an era where like New York not only ran like who the stars were, but like what the messaging was, period. Like there was no glorifying drug talk. There's, you know, maybe have like a little one or two, like, you know, Run DMC was about as like raw as you could get it, but they had the authority because it's like you could talk about Cool Chief Rucker, I don't drink Rucker, I keep a bag of cheaper inside my, you expected Run to be like, Run, you know, DJ, I run shit, you know what I'm saying? I do what I want. But apart from that, like, you know, so like literally had songs like Close the Crack House Down, you know what I'm saying? It was like,
whole movies.
That was the, there was a, and I was, that was what it was for a long, long time, you know? And like bragging about how dope you was as far as you could go, but like, you know, and you had like the Spoonie G, like, you know, the explicit stuff, you know, but that was like, that was not on the radio. Rap wasn't on the radio before an hour a week on the weekends with DJ Red Alert and, you know, like local New York radio stations. And that was it. So it was like really a street culture. You know, KRS came a Criminal Minded. It was like, but and my philosophy, it was like, it was, there was no, I didn't see it like that glorifying the gangsterism or gangster lifestyles. And there was some dudes that was like officially, legitimately like in the streets, but they just wouldn't talk about it on records, you know?
Like street legends.
Yeah, for sure. That all came from where we was growing up. I don't behave in the way that I'm expected to behave as an artist for certain audiences, you know. People have always tried to make it about one thing or the other with me or us. It's like, oh, you guys are the blackness guys, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, so that's like you run the blackness lane. You know, they even came up with these, you know, the all of these terminologies like conscious rap. And I was just like, it's kind of like very loose, ambiguous language as opposed to what, like, you know, a sleep rap. Like, what do you even mean when you say that? You know what I'm saying? Or it's like, I mean, commercial rap. It's like, well, you know, our records are for sale. So what are you really saying? Well, like, what do you, like, what type of box are you trying to put us in? And, I mean, I address a lot of different themes in my music. It's not just, you know, the theme of like my heritage or politics, you know. But as a younger person, I those things were very important to me. And they're still important to me, but I have a different understanding of them now with the passage of, you know, time and experience. And I express them in another type of way. There was a lot that I wasn't exposed to or didn't know at that time, but there was a lot that I was interested in. There was a lot that I felt on an instinctual level, and I just expressed it. But like I have always been rejecting those type of labels.
Yeah.
About like, oh, this is what you are. This is how we can categorize you and classify you, so we can arrange you as a like a consumer product.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, we were working artists who were lucky, fortunate enough, and gratefully skilled enough to be able to say that this is our profession, because there were a lot of people, as you can attest to, Qua, that was super dope. They never got to do it at this level or consistently at this level. You know, it was who, you know, deserved the shot, at least in my opinion. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And for whatever reason, you know, it just didn't happen for them that way. So that was always the victory to me. Whatever people want to call it, you know, conscious rap, backpack rap. Mm-hmm. You know, I at this point in my life or career, I'm you know, I don't want to. I want to spend my energy and time on something else besides just explaining myself or, you know, what I've been doing or what that means. It's like, if it means something to you, whatever I say, whatever I do, fine. If it doesn't, you know, mm-hmm. I at least I ain't lied to you. I wasn't like over here pretending to be something that I'm not for your approval or attention. You know, what you got and what continue to get out of me and us is a sincere expression. Whether you understand it or not, it's not a lie. You know, it's what we really, who we really are, what we really, really responding to, or what is really important to us, and I'm just leaving it at that.
Well, one of my favorite things about you as a human being is, more than any artist I know, you live your lyrics, and the idea of saying, well, you know, I'm not going to be on this label, I'm gonna focus more on the human condition, has led you to live in Africa, put roots down in Africa, and even try to convince your friends to come live in Africa and for us to invest in Africa. You sent me a video of a woman, Dr. Arikana.
Dr. Arikana, yeah.
Yeah, Chimbori Kwai. Right. And yeah, she was former ambassador of the African Union to the United States. And in this video, she speaks about the 14 African countries that still pay taxes to France. And she speaks specifically about the pact for the continuation of colonization.
The pact for the continuation of colonization. It's crazy.
Which
is the actual name of the document, apparently.
Right. Walk us down the path of how you found her video and why it's been a focus of you to get particularly Black people in America to maybe focus on Africa more.
Well, listen, you know, well, let me say this. Like, I don't want to be the king of anything except myself. I don't want to be anybody's leader. If I have an enthusiasm about something or experience that I had, I will share it with people, especially people in my circle or people that, you know, that my people, right? Mm-hmm. But whatever decision people make is on them. There are others before me who have articulated that sentiment much better or clearer than I have or ever may. So the information is out there. And if you're a person seeking that type of information or that type of experience, then what you're looking for is looking for you. That information came to me because I was interested in that information. I was looking for it, so I found it. And it was looking for me because I was looking for it. I was looking to have another type of living experience. I was looking to learn something that I may not be able to just learn through books or just having my experiences, you know, someone just living in America. I wanted to see what this world is shaped like and not just on work detail, you know what I'm saying? Just coming to a place, doing your work, you know, have the, you know, the kind of, you know, victory lap, hallelujah moment. You get back on the plane and just get back into, you know, the you know, day to day or what, you know, the quotidian, you know, grind. I wanted to experience life for myself and also for my family, you know, my youth. For them to have another type of experience, at least to have as a reference point, whatever they decide to do, is just that they can say, you know, I had that experience. I saw that. I saw that. I experienced it. I saw it happen. It happened to me. So that's why I did that. And I had the instinct to do that for pretty early on. I was a young kid, you know, standing on the roof of my projects. And I always understood that there was something more than this.
Something bigger.
There's like, you know what I'm saying? More. Like,
yeah.
And I'm not unique in that regard. And I'm not the only person that's been like, you know, something out there and we got to get to it. And I don't know how, but I know that we can.
Yeah.
I know that we got to, because if we don't, like, we got to at least, we have to at least try. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. We may not get to it, but we gotta do something, because this shit is crazy. You know, there's more to life than this. It's not to say that life is all terrible here either, but this ain't all that it is. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I just had different vision for myself. So that's what I did. And Africa was a big part of that. I didn't want anybody, you know, I didn't want anybody telling me about it. I wanted to see it for myself. And I'm grateful that I've had those experiences, and I still have those connections and, like, you know, roots in that place. So that's that. If people who are interested, you know, go see it, you know. And I know it's a challenging time now. I'm sure that a lot.
Africa's the only place that we can go for a lot of us.
Seriously,
probably the safest place on the planet right now, actually.
Probably, yeah. And, hey, you know, hey.
The New Danger was originally the Black Jack Johnson album, and it was made with members of the Black Jack Johnson band, featuring Bernie Worrell from Parliament, Funkadelic, and Will Calhoun and Doug Wimbish from Living Color.
No from Bad Brains.
Yeah, shout out to Dr. No. Recipes to Bernie Worrell as well.
Yes, recipes to Bernie Worrell. And shout out to Doc and the whole Brains crew and LC and all of the crew.
Mm-hmm. Shout out to the crew. What made you decide to celebrate the past in black music, looking backward to forward and focusing on jazzy?
I just do what I like to do. Like, none of it is like, you know, like those thoughts emerge like later, but it's like I grew up listening to rock and roll. Living Color had a big impact on me. Bad Brains had a huge impact on me. And they were cool with Bernie. Of course, Parliament had a huge impact on me. I was interested in musicianship. Around that time, Limp Bizkit and all these other groups were coming into prominence for, like, rhyming badly over kind of, like, you know, what I didn't consider, like, actual rock and roll, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And I was like, okay, well, I could do that. I could do that. So that's what I did. And the label wasn't interested in that. They was interested in hearing it from Fred Durst or Korn or Rage Against the Machine, which I, you know, after Zach left the band, I did get a call to replace Zach, but I didn't take it, though.
Right.
Because I was friends with Zach. I was friendly with Zach, and I was like, I don't want to take my man's job like that. And I was also like, you know, I got my own thing to do, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I did it, because it was sincere to me. I'm not like, you know, my thing, and pardon me, I don't mean to seem like cantankerous. To be honest, like, I'm not a very good interview giver for whatever
reason.
I'm having a great time, too.
Yeah, but that's you. This shit is like sweat for me, because like, I'm for whatever reason, people are interested in what I have to say. And
yes, they are.
But some people are not interested at all. I don't take it for granted. I don't over or underestimate any amount, you know.
I do think it's interesting that at that time in your life, to you, you like, that's just, I did what I felt like doing, but it is a courageous choice. And just because it's a natural choice for you doesn't make it any less exceptional. You know, it's definitely.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, but if I just stay living in that, and I appreciate that people appreciate it. So let me take the compliment, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's like everybody do what they want to do to some degree or other. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, we sacrifice for what we needed and wanted. If it was righteous, exactly, it was out of order. You know, we say it's in the black store thing. It's like, you know, everybody doing what they, you love who you love. Even if you faking like you don't, you doing what you want to do all the time. And if you suppressing that, it come out in other ways. So you might just do what you really want to do, at least someplace. You may, you know, it's like, in a lot of instances, more developed, I have been more developed as an artist with my artistic choices than I may have even been in my own life. You know what I'm saying? I may exhibit more courage as an artist at times, or have exhibited more, quote-unquote, courage as an artist at times than I may have exhibited as a... As